This is the second video in a series about the pantheism controversy. In our first video, we explored the philosophy of Spinoza and its reception in 18th century Germany, which spurred the pantheism controversy. In this video, we'll turn to the response to the controversy offered by Immanuel Kant, who sought to stake out a middle ground between reason and faith. Immanuel Kant, one of Germany's most influential and brilliant philosophers, is most famous for his three critiques: the critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason, and the critique of judgment. Kant lived the whole of his life in his native Königsberg, a port city in Prussia where he worked as a professor at the University of Königsberg. Legend has it that Kant lived his life with such mechanical precision that the Königsberg locals would set their watches according to Kant's daily walk, which always happened at precisely the same hour. Kant was a chief proponent of the Enlightenment in Germany, arguing for the free exercise of reason as the path forward for the ever-expanding progress of the human race. He began his philosophical career as a follower of Leibnizian rationalism, specifically via Leibniz's German interpreters, Wolff and Baumgarten. But in roughly the 1770s, Kant underwent a radical shift in his thinking from his so-called pre-critical period to his critical period, initiating a self-described Copernican revolution in philosophy. In short, the turn to human subjectivity as the locus of philosophical investigation. This shift is often attributed to Kant's encounter with the skeptical challenges, especially the problem of induction, in the work of the early modern empiricist David Hume, who Kant credits with awakening me from my dogmatic slumber. But recent scholars like Omri Boma, in his book Kant's Critique of Spinoza from 2014, have argued that the challenges posed by Spinoza were just as important, if not more so, for spurring Kant's revolutionary philosophical innovations. In particular, it was the threat that Kant took Spinoza's rationalism to pose to the very possibility of morality, and to the related moral notions of freedom, the soul, and God, which motivated Kant to find a way beyond Spinozism. If Spinoza's necessitarianism was right, then freedom of the will was impossible, since Kant regarded freedom of the will as a necessary condition for morality, since we can only be held morally responsible for actions that we freely choose, then morality would likewise be impossible. Likewise, for Kant, Spinozism entailed the denial of a transcendent moral God who could, in the fullness of time, reward the morally virtuous with happiness and punish the morally vicious with unhappiness. So in a sense, Kant agreed with Jacobi that Spinoza's philosophy leads to a kind of nihilism. The loss of a moral goal of human life, the loss of the freedom to carry it out, and the loss of a God who could ensure its ultimate fulfillment. Yet Kant could not endorse Jacobi's proposed solution to the problem of nihilism, namely an irrational leap of faith. For Kant, this would amount to a repudiation of all that was good about the Enlightenment, the freedom of thought, the free exercise of reason, the break with all the dogmatism and unthinking traditionalism of the past. Thus, Kant had to set a dual task for himself. He had to vindicate the value of reason, but in such a way that did not fall into Spinozism, thereby showing Jacobi to be wrong to think that Enlightenment rationality inevitably leads to Spinozistic nihilism. How was Kant going to square this circle? The answer? Through a critique of pure reason. By critique, Kant doesn't mean the ordinary sense of criticism or disapproval. Rather, he means it in the original sense of determining the proper bounds or limits of something, in this case of pure reason itself. In particular, Kant's critique of pure reason sets out to determine the limits of what we can know through pure reason alone, that is, the limits of our pure, rational, theoretical knowledge of reality. Without rehearsing all of Kant's very complicated arguments, let me simply present Kant's final conclusion. Kant concludes that we can only know the world as it appears to us, never as it truly is in itself. This is because we can only have knowledge of things that we can experience as we experience them. For example, all the objects of experience appear to us in space and time. But Kant argues that space and time themselves aren't objectively real. Rather, they are mere subjective forms of intuition through which our experience of the world is filtered, like space-time goggles that we can never take off. Thus, the world of our experience is merely a world of appearances, a world of phenomena, or the phenomenal world, as Kant will call it. What things in themselves are truly like, the noumena, or the noumenal world, the Ding an sich in Kant's terminology, can never be known to us. Now, Kant agrees with Spinoza that everything in the phenomenal world of appearances, that is, the world of space and time, the world of our everyday experience, does indeed obey the necessity of the laws of nature. Thus, agreeing with Spinoza, in the phenomenal world, freedom of the will is indeed impossible. But the important difference is that for Kant, the noumenal world, that is, the way things truly are in themselves, may not necessarily obey the laws of nature. Of course, since we can't have any knowledge of the noumenal world, we can't ever know one way or the other. But it is at least possible that freedom exists there. Likewise, Kant admits that the phenomenal world, the world of nature, has no room for the immortal soul or for God. But it is at least possible that the immortal soul and God exist in the noumenal world. Indeed, in his Transcendental Dialectic, Kant goes to great lengths to show that every argument in the history of philosophy, either for or against the existence of freedom, the soul, or God, is fallacious. Every attempt to either prove or disprove any of these three ideas must ultimately be unsuccessful, since these three ideas all lie beyond the boundaries of any possible experience, and so beyond our capacity to know them. Another way to put this is that we can only ever have knowledge of the conditioned objects of the natural world, but we can never have knowledge of the unconditioned or absolute objects of traditional metaphysics, freedom, the soul, and God. Despite pure reason's endless attempts to settle these great metaphysical questions, they must remain forever unknowable to us, or so Kant argues. But the crucial point is that precisely because we can never know whether or not freedom, the soul, and God exist, their existence remains possible in the noumenal world, the world of things in themselves. Kant climactically argues that this possibility makes room for faith in freedom, the soul, and God, calling this a rational faith. This might seem like a contradiction in terms. How can faith be rational? Kant argues that while theoretical reason is incapable of knowing these three ideas, practical reason, which is the source of morality, provides the basis for a rational, practical faith in these three. In other words, a moral faith. Indeed, Kant goes so far as to call this the fundamental aim of the Critique of Pure Reason. Quote, "Thus I had to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith." That is, Kant had to deny pure, rational, theoretical knowledge of freedom, the soul, and God in order to make room for a rational, practical faith in freedom, the soul, and God. Let's try to see how this is supposed to work. All of Kant's arguments for practical faith have their ground in morality, specifically in the moral law, usually known in Kantian terminology as the categorical imperative, which is the law of pure practical reason. Kant maintains that the moral law is simply a fact of reason. We are immediately aware of the fact of our own moral obligations, that is, that there are certain things we ought or ought not to do. As Kant writes at the end of the Critique of Practical Reason, and is partially inscribed on his tombstone by the Königsberg Cathedral, quote, two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the starry sky above me and the moral law within me. I do not seek or conjecture either of them, as if they were veiled obscurities or extravagances beyond the horizon of my vision. I see them before me and connect them immediately with the consciousness of my existence. Having established the moral law as a fact of reason, Kant next introduces what will later be called the ought implies can principle. If it is true that we ought to do something, then it must be possible for us to do it. In other words, we cannot have an obligation to do something that is impossible for us. Thus, if it is true that we ought to act as morality demands, then it must be possible for us to do so. In its most general form, this is the basis for Kant's argument for a practical belief in freedom. Without freedom of the will, it would be impossible for us to act morally. But since we ought to act morally, it must be possible for us to act morally, and therefore freedom must exist. Now, it is crucial that this doesn't constitute an argument for theoretical knowledge of our own freedom, since freedom can't be experienced in space and time, nor can it be demonstrated through pure theoretical reason. It is, strictly speaking, unknowable. Yet on practical and moral grounds, Kant maintains that we must rationally believe that we are free, given the fact of the moral law within. That is, we must have a rational, practical faith in freedom. Comparable arguments for rational faith in the soul and in God emerge from a consideration of the ultimate goal of morality, which Kant calls the highest good, or summum bonum, namely, perfect moral virtue, plus the perfect correspondence of moral virtue with happiness. To run these arguments very quickly, if ought implies can, since we ought to achieve perfect moral virtue, it must be possible for us to achieve it. Kant argues that perfect moral virtue, the first half of the highest good, is an infinite goal that requires an infinite amount of time to achieve through an infinite process of moral self-improvement. Thus, perfect moral virtue is only possible if we exist for an infinite amount of time. That is, if we have an immortal soul. Therefore, we must have a practical, rational faith in the immortality of the soul as a condition of possibility for doing what we ought to do. Likewise, Kant argues that the perfect correspondence of moral virtue with happiness, the second half of the highest good, is only possible if God exists. The world of nature, of time and space, does not contain the basis for this correspondence within itself. The righteous suffer, while the wicked prosper. Only if there is a transcendent moral author of nature, with perfect knowledge, power, and goodness, could this correspondence be assured through a final dispensation of reward and punishment, or something of the sort. Since we ought to achieve this perfect correspondence of moral virtue with happiness, and since this is possible if and only if God exists, then we must have a practical, rational faith that God exists. For many, it seemed as if Kant had saved the day, that he'd found a way to have his rational divine cake and eat it too, to hold on simultaneously to both reason and God, without either taking an irrational leap of faith into the abyss, nor becoming adrift in the sea of cosmic meaninglessness. But did he really manage to do it? Is practical rational faith a satisfactory solution to the problem of nihilism? Kant's contemporaries didn't seem to think so. For one, Kant's denial of knowledge of God, they argued, threatens to do away with God altogether. Thus, the German Jewish poet Heinrich Heine drew a provocative comparison between Kant and the leader of the French Revolution, Maximilien Robespierre. While Robespierre had killed a king, namely Louis XVI by guillotine, Kant had killed God, God's self, through the philosophical guillotine of the Critique of Pure Reason, by abolishing all theoretical knowledge of God. In a similar vein, Mendelssohn called Kant the all-destroyer for destroying all the traditional metaphysical proofs for God, the soul, and freedom. Hegel would go on to say that Kant's philosophy was symptomatic of the then contemporary state of European civilization, in which the death of God was inescapable. In more concrete philosophical terms, the post-Kantian German idealists would all express their dissatisfaction with Kant's many dualisms: phenomena versus noumena, nature versus freedom, theory versus practice, is versus ought, knowledge versus faith, and so on. For Kant's critics, these unwarranted and unresolved dualisms bespoke Kant's unreconciled or alienated vision of the human being and their place in the world. We are all split or torn in two between the various sides of these oppositions, each of which expresses a kind of wound or rift in the human spirit, which Kant's critics thought could only be healed by going beyond Kant. In the Kantian system, his critics maintained, we are, first of all, cut off from nature. Nature is treated as a mere appearance or phenomenon, a veil of illusion hiding the true noumenal world. Missing from Kant's picture, they argue, is something akin to Spinoza's grand vision of our harmony with nature, our place in the natural world, and the holistic interconnectivity of all natural beings. Likewise, in the Kantian system, they argued we are cut off from God. We can never truly know God, restricted as we are to a merely practical faith in God's existence. For Kant, God remains an utterly unknowable and inscrutable being, forever beyond our reach. Missing from Kant's picture is something like Spinoza's grand vision of our intellectual love of God as a part of the infinite love with which God loves God's self, a deep harmony and union between humanity and God, achieved above all through knowledge of God. After all, doesn't Scripture teach that above all God desires to be known by human beings? And as both Plato and Aristotle put it, God is not jealous, such that God would withhold knowledge of God's self from us. Rather, God freely gives us the possibility of knowing God out of God's overflowing goodness. Finally, even given Kant's steadfast dedication to human freedom, it is difficult, his critics argued, to make out the relation between human action and divine action in his system. Granted that we must always work towards bringing about the highest good through our moral activity, yet it is only God who can finally make this highest good a reality. What role do human beings actually play within the gradual unfolding of the world towards its goal, if any? Do we matter to God's plan? Could God do it alone without our help? Kant's critics felt that questions such as these were left unresolved in Kant's philosophical system. Despite Kant's groundbreaking philosophical innovations, all of these problems and questions would push the next generation of German philosophers to break with Kant. Specifically, inspired by the renewal of interest in Spinoza, thanks to Jacobi's unintended popularization of his work in the pantheism controversy. As a new day dawned for German philosophy, it would be a grand new synthesis of Spinoza and Kant that would carry the project first initiated by the Enlightenment forward, and even ultimately beyond itself into something new. Stay tuned to the next video in the series, where we'll explore Hegel's efforts to solve the pantheism controversy by reconciling Spinoza and Kant, thereby attempting to complete the grand journey from nihilism to absolute spirit. Until then, as always, keep seeking.